fright is real or perceived, is actually the fact that we have got to give them the confidence to believe that they can do that. And so when
Jeff,
I talk about...
just one question, because we're coming up to the news now, finally. Has the mayor been batting enough up at Westminster? Yes or no?
He's been batting
yes
for Bristol. He's been batting for Bristol, but he's not batting for the police commissioner.
Most people around the table are saying no. Anyway, we're going into the news now. We're back after the news.
This is Bristol's
BCFM. So we're doing our local election debate. See you after the news for another hour.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Ed Miliband's been criticised for suggesting David Cameron could have anticipated the migrants crisis in the Mediterranean. The Prime Minister's rejected the claim made by the Labour leader, who said the situation was triggered in part by his intervention in Libya in 2011. Meanwhile, the alleged captain of the migrant boat which capsized last weekend, killing more than 800 people, has appeared in court. Earlier, actress Angelina Jolie, UN Special Envoy on Refugee Issues, told its Security Council the world has a moral duty to help fleeing migrants get to safety.
It is sickening to see thousands of refugees drowning on the doorstep of the world's wealthiest continent. No one risks the lives of their children in this way except out of utter desperation.
The second person's been charged over the fatal shooting of a Syrian-born preacher in North London. Abdul Hadi Alawani was found dead in a car in Wembley earlier this month. Prince Charles and Prince Harry are marking the centenary of the Gallipoli campaign, one of Britain's worst military disasters. Around 58,000 Allied troops died. Staying indoors too much is apparently behind a big rise in short-sightedness among children. Emma Jones has more.
In the 1960s, 10% of British 12 and 13-year-olds were short-sighted. It's now 23%, according to a study, and the problem's that not enough youngsters are getting outdoors regularly.
I don't play outdoors with my friends as much. I get a bit distracted on my iPads.
Experts say it's not just technology to blame.
For many years, we've known there's a link between education and myopia.
Particularly in East Asia, where school days are much longer. The report's author says that's led to drastic measures.
Actually, in China, they've trialled glass-roofed classrooms.
There are now calls for pupils to have more lessons outside.
And Rotherham now have an even tougher battle against relegation from the Championship. The club's been deducted 3 points for fielding an ineligible player. That's the latest. I'm Annie Joyce.
L'Afrique est pleine de tristesse de voir nos familles mourir. Ne touchons pas nos malades, ne touchons pas nos mourants. Tout le monde est en danger, les jeunes et les anciens. Il faut agir pour nos familles.
BCFM is very proud to support the Every Child Deserves a Future fundraising gala dinner in support of survivors of the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone. This event includes a sumptuous meal, auction, presentations, and stunning entertainment from artists Kizzy Morell, Celestine Walcott-Gordon, Ed Chuckle, and poet Miles Chambers, to name just a few. Funds raised from the dinner will be used to provide education and counselling services for survivors of the Ebola virus and their families. Every Child Deserves a Future takes place on May 16th at Colston Hall. It starts sharp at 6 p.m. and will be followed by an after party at Plantation Caribbean Bar and Restaurant. Tickets for this very special occasion cost £50 or £100 for the VIP option. To get your tickets or to sponsor this very worthy cause, please call African Voices Forum on 07862 729 403. Or email them at africanvoicesforum@yahoo.co.uk.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. It's just after 6 o'clock. We're here at the City Academy, Bristol Community Radio, and around the table I've got the politicians from the five main parties in the city. That is the Conservative, Jeff Gollop, Labour Group Leader Helen Holland, Lib Dems also Group Leader, he's Gary Hopkins, Tim Malnick, he's a Green Councillor, and Michael Frost from the UK Independence Party. And I'd like to start on the second part by talking about something that Helen Holland mentioned in the first part, which was the LEP, Local Enterprise Partnership, because these kinds of organisations, partnerships, are starting to do more and more of what used to be done by council committees. And I'd just like to just go around the table, starting with you, Jeff, and ask you whether you think that these kinds of partnerships are working, are they successful, and particularly the LEP, Local Enterprise Partnership.
Well, I think the Local Enterprise Partnership is very much working in the right direction. They're tasked with creating jobs, creating investment into the west of England. Unfortunately, we're saddled with that name, because if you ask anybody what they think of the west of England, they'd all come up with a different answer. Basically, the west of England is what used to be the County of Aden. And the Local Enterprise Partnership is making headway in investment, creating jobs. And it's providing a mechanism for the local authorities to work together, which might prove a bigger challenge if they were left to their own devices to do that. But working with industry to achieve is giving a real opportunity to move forward. It provides a mechanism for government funding for some of the bigger transport projects that we need in the region as well. So I would say it's moving forward, but like so many things, it could actually do with more funding, and the LEP is only funded from funds that the local authorities can procure from central government. And it's restricted.
Yep, the thing that bothers me is that a lot of these meetings at local enterprise partners is spending quite a lot of public money, but they're not open and accountable. They're business people. I mean, I've just got a list of those who were actually send people to. I think, am I right, local authorities will send a councillor to these meetings, and also they're also the CBI, the Institute of Directors, and Business West, and something else called FSB, I think it's the Federation of Small Businesses, elect people to these bodies, and they then spend public money. Well, is that right, that they should be spending public money?
But any money that is spent on behalf of Bristol would go through the normal scrutiny process within Bristol for it to be spent in the appropriate way.
Helen.
Well, I think you're right. I've already alluded to this, because I think that you know, there are differing views about how good LEPs in general are, and then about how good or not the West of England one is. And you're right. Business has got the greatest voice on there. Each council can only send its leader, and the meetings are not really transparent, although they're, as I understand it, trying harder to put some issues onto their website. But I think we do need to see a reform of the LEP, because if it's public money, then it ought to be a publicly accountable body. And I think that people, councillors, don't feel as if we've got any handle on what the LEP does. And so some of those issues that I alluded to earlier about the skills gap and, you know, Bristol people getting the jobs that are coming into our city. I think that maybe the social agenda isn't as high on the LEP's agenda as we would wish it to be. So they're probably happy if jobs have been created. They're not saying, who are those jobs for? And are we making sure that Bristol people from South Bristol who've been excluded from a lot of the, you know, up-and-coming job sectors, are getting those jobs? So we need them to focus on making sure that that work is done, and that it becomes economically better off area, but for everybody, not increasing the gap.
Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems, what were your thoughts about the Local Enterprise Partnership? It's not a very visible organisation, is it? But it's actually spending quite a lot of public money.
No, and unfortunately quite a lot of what goes on in the City Council isn't very visible either to a lot of councillors and the public, so it's not unique. I think, you know, in terms of the major transport investment, etc., actually, all those initiatives that are progressing at the moment were initiated by the partnership of the four authorities previously, before the Local Enterprise Partnership became involved. Now, I think that the key to this is that we were told, and there's a lot of truth in it, that you can get quicker decisions with the structure that we have at the moment. And that's fine. But those quicker decisions have got to be available for scrutiny. Check how the money is actually spent. Is it doing the job that it needs to do? And that's what we need to have, and it's what we need to have within a city council. I mean, I sat through a meeting, as did Helen the other night, where we were looking at the new energy company for Bristol, a wholly owned company by the city council. Great. We put forward the plan for this initially about three or four years ago, and it's now going to become a reality. But you know what? Basically, councillors who are representing the people in Bristol were not to have a scrutiny role in terms of looking at, is the balance right? Is the environmental policy right? Is the financial policy and how it actually deals with vulnerable customers right? So we are not, at the moment, destined to have any influence on that at all. And that, quite frankly, is disgraceful.
Tim Malnick for the Greens, what are your thoughts about this local enterprise partnership?
I think
one of the things, before you start, one of the things I noticed that they were involved in is helping fund Western College, for example, to buy the winter gardens. I mean, this is out of the city, but down in Western, for £1. And a lot of people were complaining, including the civic society down in Western, saying, well, hang on, this is a massive asset transfer to a much less public body from the Western Council. I think it's actually North Somerset Council. So things are going away from public ownership to less accountable bodies, and the local enterprise partnership are funding it. But the biggest problem to me is that they're, you know, if I want to go and report on a local enterprise partnership meeting, I can't do that.
Yeah. Well, I think you describe it very well, and you've clearly researched it better than me, Tony.
Well, I've tried.
But let me say from my point, I agree. It's not an area I have in-depth knowledge, but I agree, and I agree with the points made so far. I think from our perspective, there are two main issues. Clearly, we're all agreed that partnerships can be useful to do bigger projects that connect different local authorities and can pull money from central government. So there's nothing wrong with partnerships in principle. Two issues we have. One is they really are not very transparent. Most people won't have heard of it. Most people will have no idea who sits on them. And even councillors have a pretty hard time finding out really how decisions are made. And there has been a suggestion, I think we've all read from an organisation called the Centre for Public Scrutiny, that if we're going to do more work through partnerships, then we need something like a local or regional audit committee, something like that, that has full access not just to look at council data, but to look at related data from the businesses and all the organisations involved. And if I just make one other point, the other issue is I have no problem with businesses being involved in this, and that might surprise people, but I've been working in a business school for the last 10 years and I work with multinationals from around the world on business. The issue here is that are other sectors who also create wealth and jobs adequately represented? All the organisation you mentioned there champion largely commercial for-profit businesses. I would like to see where's the representation from the social enterprise sector, major and growing player in the city. What about the voluntary and community sector? All of these run powerful organisations that create jobs and wealth. So my worry is we're not getting the diversity of views to really create real wealth for the city, and we get a narrow-minded approach.
What about you, Michael Frost, for the UK?
Well, the problem
UK
being the problem of being the last person to speak is everybody's said just about everything that needs to be said. I concur with what Helen Holland has said as well, but I just made a few notes while everybody was talking, and the key issues that seem to come up as bullet points are. Are they accountable? Can they be scrutinised? That creates public suspicion. How effective are they? What are the costs? And the whole thing hangs around transparency, as Councillor Hopkins said. And those are issues, I think, that are not healthy for something like this.
Okay, let's talk about immigration, which is on a lot of people's minds this week, particularly with the programmes and news footage, etc., on the television of people dying trying to get across from North Africa. And maybe we'll start with you on this, Gary Hopkins, about whether you think that the city is able to cope with more migrants and whether that actually denudes the services we're able to offer to everybody.
Well, I think that Bristol, being a very diverse city, it actually helps us. Having said that, in terms of public services, there's always a squeeze on resources, and we need to have more, be allowed to keep more of our money in Bristol, and then we would be able to provide the services properly, because Bristol is a net exporter of money to government, and really, if we had more of our own resources, we could look after a lot of the services in Bristol somewhat better. I've got to say, I thought some of the comments earlier on today from Ed Miliband were extremely regrettable. Yeah. I thought it was extremely poor, attacking world leaders for that, you know, that problem that's a concurrent in the Mediterranean.
Well, and effectively, wasn't he attacking your party to a certain extent, wasn't he?
He's attacking everybody, basically, and it's all a matter of, with hindsight, four times Ed Miliband actually voted against having a proper inquiry into the Iraq war, which actually has caused a lot of the problems that we actually suffer from in the world today in terms of instability.
I mean, he was talking specifically about Libya, wasn't he, which is where many of these migrants are coming from now.
Well, and quite frankly, you know, if you were in that position, you would be on the move as well, and you would be wanting a place like Bristol to be able to take you in and look after you, and then you'd want to be giving back, which is what happens with a lot of the people that are taken into Bristol.
Michael Frost from UK Independence Party is itching to say something. Now, I think there's two ends to this question, Michael. I'm not sure if you'd agree with me. One is the foreign policy that has created the disaster in North Africa and in the Middle East, where tens of thousands of people are trying to escape, on the one hand. And secondly, the effect that that has on a city like Bristol.
Okay, well, let's take those points in the order that you've presented them. First of all, it is an absolute tragedy that I think it was 800 people have lost their lives in such an appalling way. And anybody with any humanity would see that problem is deep-rooted. Ed Miliband's comments today just proves his naivety on world affairs. It's caused such an outcry, and I can't believe that somebody who hopefully won't be our Prime Minister but could possibly be would make such a crass and uninformed decision. But moving on to whether we should help out.
I mean, on that particular point, I mean, David Cameron, when Colonel Gaddafi was killed, he was actually executed by a mob, wasn't he?
Yes.
David Cameron went over straight away to Libya in a sort of triumphal way, saying, wow, isn't this wonderful? Well, clearly it isn't wonderful.
What, that he was executed by a mob, or he's not murdering people his own free will anymore?
That Gaddafi was gone.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing he's gone. It's obviously it's regrettable the way he did go. I'd rather have seen him standing in a court of law and being dealt with in a humane sort of way.
Like Saddam Hussein.
This sort of barbarism is rampant across the Middle East. And that's a whole new debate, I know. But I want to really come back to the point and the question that you asked about the resources. Bristol and other major cities in this country and the NHS, schools, local services are just buckling under the weight of dealing with the people that need to be taken care of. We can't import thousands of people and expect our services and schools to look after them. And that might sound like a hard thing to say, but we just can't do it. We're a small island off the northwest coast of Europe. We have our own, you know, problems to deal with. And it's not that I'm not taking an unhumanitarian view. You know, if people are in real dire straits and they need help, then of course we would provide that. But we can't just open the doors and let all these people come in.
Helen Holland, we've had a couple of references to comments by Ed Miliband earlier on today, which is really suggesting that perhaps that the foreign policy of the current administration, that is essentially David Cameron and the coalition government, in encouraging the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, has actually caused this. So what's your reaction to the criticism?
Comes in. I meant to say something which is pertinent to what I think she may lead into. If you look at the cause of the first Iraq war, you had Tony Blair, you had the dodgy dossier and all this stuff that came up. You know, he played a massive part in this, but no, Labour don't want to talk about that anymore.
It's the second Iraq war,
airbrush him out of the whole thing.
Helen?
My understanding is that what Ed Miliband particularly was drawing attention to was the fact that, as you've said, Tony, that David Cameron went over there as quickly as he could with President Sarkozy, who was the French president at the time, to take their part of the success, if you want to call it that, of the overthrow of Gaddafi. And his words, and I've just heard them actually on the radio as I was coming in this afternoon, his words, David Cameron's words to the Libyan people were, you know, you've done a great thing and we will stand with you in the future. Well, clearly, not only this country, but the international community hasn't stood with Libya, and it hasn't got a democratic process in Libya. And so you can understand why Libyan people want to escape that, but also because the coast of Libya is unpoliced, if you like, that is the funnel for people from other places with unrest coming out of North Africa. But to the point about Bristol has signed up as a city of sanctuary, and that had cross-party support. But I think some people are beginning to say, what does that actually mean in practice? And I have to disagree here about Bristol and the pressure on services, because actually the pressure on services, much of that is being supported by immigrant labour. If you have been into the BRI recently, you'll know that everybody at every level in the BRI, from cleaners right up to consultants, there are foreign nationals or British nationals, people who are British now, and also newer communities who work in the BRI, they work in Southmead, they're working in the NHS, they're working right across the public sector. And many of our services we know could not survive if it wasn't for that additional labour. So I think there's a bit of hypocrisy here about how dependent we are on immigrant labour and immigration into our city to keep many of the services going. And personally, and the Labour Party, we welcome the diversity of this city, but we recognise that much more has to be done to make sure that newer communities here feel part of the city and can contribute. And this almost comes back to that question about how and where are decisions taken. People who do not feel that they've got a stake in Bristol are not going to positively contribute. People who do will do, and so we need to be making more effort.
What about the simple question that migrant labourers are undercutting work that trade unions in this country have been doing for years to keep wages at a sensible level? That is to say, more what we like to call the living wage rather than the minimum wage. So it has driven wages down, having more workers available.
Well, I think it's been made very clear that actually where you find that employers are paying under the living wage or the minimum wage, then those cases have to be reported, and we have to have a situation where people are getting a decent day's pay for a decent day's work.
Anyway, Jeff Gollop, what's your thoughts about this, about particularly about the comments by the Prime Minister earlier on today about Libya, and then about the effect that these kinds of mass migrations across the world, I'm put in mind of the migration in the 1800s when you had people being forced out of their homes in Ireland and then shipped across to the United States. It's a similar kind of mass movement of people from a place where actually they're being denied the ability to stay where they want to live.
I find this a very difficult issue, and I think it's one you comment on with the risk of being proved wrong very soon by some other international event happening. And the way I look at this is that we have pressures in Africa at the moment where people are finding themselves in situations where their own lives and the lives of their family are so seriously at risk that they are taking desperate decisions. And I don't feel happy with any politician in this country then posturing for votes in dealing with something that is a humanitarian crisis. And that's a personal view, but I've always had a philosophy that you treat other people the way you would want to be treated yourself. And I think in terms of the international problems, I have to say I think it would be better if all leaders only made contributions when they felt there was something really positive to say.
So what do you think about David Cameron's comments, you know, back when Gaddafi was killed? Was it wise, do you think, to, number one, take part in the overthrow of a sovereign state, a foreign leader, and then secondly, to go over and in a way congratulate the people for an armed uprising?
There isn't a right answer. There isn't a right answer, because if you do nothing, you're negligent, because actually you failed to influence an outcome. And if you do take part in influencing the outcome, you're interfering with a sovereign state. But can I just talk about the Bristol situation?
Sure.
Because actually, you know, Helen's talked about engaging. One of the things we have to do is engage with all our communities. That is with the immigrant community, and that includes some large groups of population who actually feel very excluded, but it's actually to also engage with the poorer white community who feel very alienated as well. But I can tell you, representing a middle-class ward, the middle classes don't feel too included in what the city's doing either. So actually, there is a whole remit where we have to look at how we deal with our communities, how we engage with them. I personally don't believe we should be providing specific services for incoming communities. What we should be doing is ensuring that we provide the very best service to all who are vulnerable and all who need it across the city.
What about the general overall effect? One of the effects of having a massive increase in migrant labour is that more and more people now are in work, but they're also having to claim benefits. So the government's effectively subsidising those employers.
Indeed, and where Helen talked about the living wage, the Labour Party not only convinced the Mayor of the importance of that, but they certainly convinced me that we have to get away from the situation where the state is subsidising large employers to pay people a minimum wage rather than a living wage. And the figures quite clearly reflect that if you do pay the higher living wage, that money is recycled into the local economy as well, and therefore produces a much more significant contribution to the local economy. And it cannot be acceptable that large employers are employing people at a level below which they can't afford to live, and where they need benefits and tax credits to enable them to do so. And I believe that is a very important policy, and I think it has been well argued by the Labour Party and the unions. I started off very opposed to it, and have listened and learnt, and had meetings with those who are encouraging us to apply it. And it's important, I think, that the City Council doesn't just decide we are going to do it for our staff. It's actually that we're a leader in the community. We require it in our contracts, and we actually go out there and encourage the business community in Bristol, because, you know, we've talked at various stages about jobs. It is actually fundamentally important to the economy of Bristol that we are creating apprenticeships and trainees from some of the most deprived areas of Bristol, and not that we are creating white collar jobs for people who live in surrounding authorities.
That's an uphill struggle, Jeff, isn't it? Because, you know, ultimately wages are going down for whatever reason. Anyway, Tim, your chance to talk about this, the immigration, the two ends really. One,
yeah,
which is the the situation in the Mediterranean, and the other is the effect of this and other things on migrant workers coming
to
Bristol.
So there are two questions. There's something about how our leadership deals with the complexity of a long-term foreign policy, and there's something about how a city responds to more and more people coming. I think our leadership for certainly my adult lifetime has been incredibly short term in the way they think about intervention. And I do understand in Libya it was a very, very tough choice. So I'm not questioning the actual intervention because there were some terrible massacres at stake. But what troubles me, and certainly from the Green perspective, is the lack of follow through. It's the lack of really sticking around and having the skills and the mindset to build peace, build back communities. It's not even nation building, because often these aren't about nations. If I can just say a little bit more.
Can you just say what you think about Ed Miliband's intervention? Do you think it was
actually,
right for him
actually,
to
I haven't heard it because I've been
he
working
said
at my job all day.
Well, he's
today,
basically
so
today, he said that David Cameron bears some responsibility for what's happening right now in the Mediterranean with hundreds, thousands of migrant people trying to get across.
I didn't hear the comments. Let me just say a bit more, because I think what I'm suggesting is, because these things are vastly complex, all of our leadership, so that would include Blair and other administrations, we all are in some way responsible. So I didn't hear it, and I wouldn't make party political capital. But I think all administrations need to understand something about long-term foreign policy, the complexity of dealing with countries and groups of people that have a way of life very different from ours, and we often try and intervene and just say, oh, it'll be a Western democracy now, and I think that's the height of arrogance and stupidity. Another thing, there was a recent House of Commons committee looking at how austerity measures had impacted on our diplomats. And we have far fewer diplomats who are the people who get to know long-term the situation in different countries, build relationships. So again, that's another real impact of our ability to actually be helpful rather than unhelpful in different countries in the world. In terms of Bristol and the UK, I think one of the big problems with this immigration story is a lot of issues that people do worry about, housing, jobs, transport, are blamed on immigrants. But actually in Bristol, we'd like central government to let us build more social housing. We have a cap on how we do that, and we have policies about selling them off rather than building them. We could build more houses. We would like the freedom to have much more local say over transport. So because we have a local authority, we're very limited on actually, can we re-regulate the buses? So I think a lot of issues people will pin down on too many people, like Nigel Farage saying a traffic jam on the M4 was caused by migrants, actually could be dealt with by skillful city planning to create more houses, more jobs and more transport.
Well, we're going to talk now. Hang on, Helen. Sorry, Helen, but we're going to move on to another subject. You can talk about, we have a sum up at the end where you can say what you want, but we're going to go on to talk about a subject I can't imagine any other parties other than the Greens really thinking this is important, but it's something I picked up on, which is food security. And it's to do with the fact that we're living in a city. Actually, many of our cities were designed originally to serve great industries. Many of those industries are now gone. And there's still a big divide between what goes on in the countryside and what goes on in the city. So I tracked down dairy farmer Derek Mead, who's standing as an independent candidate in North Somerset, and asked him about food security. How long, for example, can the system by which we get our food through our supermarkets, is it actually sustainable? How long can Britain feed itself if, for example, there was a problem with the ash cloud and we couldn't get food into the country? So we're going to hear now from Derek Mead.
Derek Mead, dairy farmer from Ryan Weston Supermare. We are only 60% self-sufficient in food. So really, if the ports were blocked, and one crisis that was nearly boiling was when the Icelandic dust cloud came over. And a lot of people didn't know, and everybody kept it under wraps, because a lot of our vegetables and perishable food comes in on the bottom decks of passenger planes. And of course, they weren't flying. And the supermarkets were really panicking. The potential for British agriculture, if it's handled properly, is tremendous. And when it comes to balance of payments, it's a terrible situation. Well, I think the first thing that's got to be done, we've got to have a more proactive, coordinated union to actually deal with the situation. And one of your main problems is, a lot of it is controlled by DEFRA, and DEFRA are not fit for purpose. We've just seen the latest cock-up is they commissioned a new computer, which has cost them about £130 million, and they're abandoning it. if it wasn't for the European Union, personally, I think British agriculture would be in a worse situation because they stick up very much more for their agriculture than we do. This country is suffering quite badly, and you see the demise of the dairy industry, which is a golden example of this, whereby we're only 83% self-sufficient in milk. The government are quite happy just to let it drift and die. You know, there's a lot of very good young farmers that are going out of business because they keep cutting the price. Well, you can actually see what's going on. If you get a heavy snowstorm, all the government or the road for agencies worry about is keeping the motorways open so that the supermarkets can actually distribute the food. If everything was shut and the borders were shut, it would only be a matter of days before this country would see supermarket shelves empty. DEFRA, now they degraded it. You know, we haven't even got a Minister of Agriculture now. That is a sign of what they think of British agriculture.
North Somerset farmer Derek Mead there with some of his worries about why, well, he thinks anyway, the central government isn't taking agriculture seriously. Quite surprisingly, he was very much in favour of some of the policies that have been brought in by the European Union. Anyway, let's go around the table now. We've got with us Michael Frost from UK Independence Party, Tim Malnick from the Greens, Gary Hopkins from the Liberal Democrats, Helen Holland from Labour, and Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives. So what are your thoughts, first of all, Michael, about this business of the fact, essentially, that we haven't actually got food reserves anymore. We're dependent on flying them in from other countries, and the government has just got rid of the Agriculture Ministry.
Well, I think you know what I'm going to say as a UKIP supporter. The EU has gone a long way to decimate a lot of our traditional food producing industries.
He's saying the opposite, actually, isn't he? As a farmer, he's saying the EU is the only thing that's taking it seriously. Central government here in Britain isn't.
Yeah, but the thing is, a lot of the farmers have been paid off by the EU to do nothing when they should actually be doing what they're good at doing, which is producing food. The fishing industry has been decimated with the quota system. It is a very big subject that you've got to really look at how we got. It's like the old Irish saying is, if I was going to sort this, I wouldn't be starting from here.
Well,
this is something that has evolved.
The Common Agricultural Policy's EU farm subsidies, that makes sure it guarantees an income for farmers. Surely that's a good thing.
Well, it's good, I suppose, if you haven't got dairy farmers that would rather flush their milk down the drain because they can't make any money, and fishing boats that can't go out to sea because huge Spanish trawlers have come in and hoovered up all of the fish from our native waters.
What about the supermarkets? Because one of the things you constantly hear from those who are growing our food that we eat every day, at least if it's grown here in Britain, is the supermarkets are the devils in all this, forcing down the prices all the time, incredibly competitive.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In fact, I had an agreement with one of my Green colleagues here a moment ago that flying in runner beans from Zimbabwe on a jet or whatever is just completely ridiculous. We can grow our own food here. I read something a little while ago, again, I'm a bit sketchy on the percentages, but it was something like only 15% of our country is actually inhabited by people. We've got vast areas and fields. I earn my living driving around trying to sell things to people, so I see the countryside and I see vast fields that look to me like they're full of weeds. And is that the set-aside policy where they're not allowed to grow, or they can only grow so much?
Well, you know, they're not weeds anymore. A lot of them are solar farms. Anyway,
the other issue.
Cue the Greens. Yeah. Tim Malnick from the Green Party. So, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so we didn't hear the piece, but we were talking in this room about should there be a major catastrophe or breakdown or no petrol. We reckon we've got 3 days to provide food for our city before all hell breaks loose. And so food security is a massive, massive issue. At the moment, there's a central government model, or you would call it a globalised capitalist model that assumes you can pay for things to be grown in other countries and flown around the world and come into our supermarkets just in time. And that's based on an assumption that there will always be cheap oil Which is used to fly things and also grow things.
It's actually getting cheaper at the moment.
Cheap labour, yes, but it will run out, and it has other implications like CO2. So it's based on a model of the world of this endless, infinite supply that just isn't right. So we absolutely need to stimulate more local food. I have to say, I think it was an absolute tragedy that the Metrobus development has basically going to concrete over some grade one agricultural land. Some of the best land for growing local food in the country is going to be turned into sort of roads and bus stops.
But as Michael was saying, quite a lot of our good land is just set aside.
No, this is top quality land. Some of that won't be nearly as productive. Hang on. We can get into the debate. It's listed as grade one. It's the best land in the country for growing things, and we're concreting it over. If I can just say one other thing about food security, which I think is really important, we need to look at waste of food, and that's connected with how we all eat, how we use food, but also how supermarkets like to sell things. RAP, who are a government organisation looking at waste in all sectors, estimate we probably throw away, one way or another, 30 to 40% of food that's bought. So there is some slack in the system if we're prepared to kind of put up with apples that might be odd shapes or have a little bit of a soil on them. So I think we need to massively rethink how we feed ourselves.
Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems, what are your thoughts? Is this a really an important issue, food security? We've just been hearing possibly only 3 days food supply, then that's it.
The worst issue is actually quite important, and I actually lost count of the number of emails I had when we brought in the waste food collection, separate collection. Number of people who wrote to me and said, I didn't realise how much food I was throwing away until it was actually separated and I could see it. And it made a significant difference to the way a lot of people actually did their purchases and the way that they actually lived their lives. And there's a huge amount of waste. And all of us individually have got a responsibility there. I mean, it might be just because I'm very mean, but I don't throw away much food, you know. And I think that the way that we actually do things is individually is important. In terms of, you know, we should not be importing food, I actually think there has to be a balance, because bananas don't grow very well in Bristol, you know, and we want bananas, and there are economies in different parts of the world that actually depend upon.
I think Tim Melnick's about to tell us just, they do grow well in Bristol.
No, I thought you were going to say they don't grow on trees. what I was
well,
going to say
is they're not trees.
the very quick point, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't import, we just need to really understand the implications of what we choose to import when. It's not about not ever importing food.
Yeah, I mean, food security is an issue to be considered, along with energy security. We're not a completely isolated section, you know, an island in the middle of the sea that doesn't communicate and doesn't trade with other places. Trade is important, you know, and basically there has to be a balance in everything that we do.
Helen Holland for the Labour Party. I've brought this in, but I mean, it is for many people. I mean, looking at for example, the world financial situation, countries like Argentina and Russia have had enormous problems with their financial systems, which have crashed at different times in the past. In which point you can't just simply pick up a phone and order something because you don't have the money to buy it. So essentially, what are your thoughts about the way that agriculture is working, whether it's working, the supermarkets, and how we get our food?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you're saying about other economies where people couldn't afford, or they couldn't ring up and order things because they couldn't afford it or they weren't there. Actually, coming back to my original point about this being a very divided city, some of the poorest people in this city are the people who are expected to pay most for their food because they haven't got supermarkets or convenience stores in their communities. And I know some people throw up their hands in horror about supermarkets, but I can tell you, in the community that I've represented for 24 years, the difference that bringing Morrison's to Symes Avenue has made, both in terms of regenerating Symes Avenue and the jobs that it's provided, but also meaning that local people could walk to a supermarket and get decent food cheaply. So I think that a kind of anti-supermarket knee-jerk reaction is sometimes not the right thing for people who are paying more for their... I'm not saying that about the people around the room here, but we've heard it umpteen times before in Bristol. And so there is a responsibility. I mean, some of this is big global stuff or national or European stuff, and us as Bristol City Councillors aren't going to be able to have a huge effect on it. But some of the work that my colleague Brenda Massey on the Mayor's Cabinet has been doing around school food, you know, that is a very important thing as well. And we can get a supply chain from local suppliers into school kitchens so that we're doing more of that kind of thing. I think that you're right that we see underutilised agricultural land, and I do think that it isn't inconsistent to say that you want good, you know, factory farming methods that are, or not necessarily factory farming, but good methods that get the absolute most out of our land. But people are very resistant to paying the true cost of their food. You think you can get milk very cheaply. It probably isn't right, but it takes a very brave politician to say that we ought to be paying more for things. As it happens, we've got an allotment, we grow our own, we've got chickens, we've got bees, and I think that people do enjoy doing that, but it's unrealistic to expect everybody to be able to do it.
I know, actually, Britain is one of the countries, I mean, many places on the continent, for example, a lot of people have chickens in the backyard and that sort of thing. Anyway, Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives, one of the things, I mean, we could bring in here is the announcement last weekend that there's now 1 million food banks, not 1 million people, but 1 million times that people have to visit food banks a year. And so food security for the poorest in our society is getting pretty appalling. They can't even afford, through their benefits, to go and get enough food from the supermarket. They've got to go cap in hand to either a doctor or the Citizens Advice Bureau and beg, essentially, for a food bank voucher.
Well, I mean, Helen talked about the fact that in some areas we have those who can least afford it having to pay the highest prices for their food, and even more ironically, they have to pay the highest prices to get their cash out of a cash machine, and so actually we and for their energy and for all those other things, which actually we are not getting right, but the things we can do as a community. And there are quite a number of projects in Green Capital here, because actually about ensuring that our children actually know where the food comes from. Because one of the very frightening things is, in a number of those communities, people don't actually understand what is needed to produce the food that they buy, because they buy it in a package or in a tin. So actually part of that understanding and awareness is really important. It's really embarrassing to find yet another thing I have in common with Gary, because we don't waste food either. And I think it is beyond my comprehension that 40% of food is wasted across the board. That isn't answering the overall question about food security, but what it is saying is, again, part of that education and awareness, because we are wasting a scarce resource. And actually, whether it's produced in this country or whether there's been any number of air miles in getting it here, to then waste it is offensive. So I believe we have got to look at the educating and the awareness, but as a council, we do have a responsibility to our most vulnerable communities and doing what we can to encourage a proper choice of shops at affordable and competitive prices. And I believe we do have to look at bringing a real moral pressure on those shops that do exist, that are exploiting their monopoly position by overcharging, because that should be highlighted. It is a disgrace.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier on, the City Council spends around about £370 million of our money every year. That's what these elections, to a large extent, are about: who is going to be spending that money and who's going to be deciding how our money's spent. Two big projects are in the offing at the moment. One is the Metro bus, which is costing £200 million altogether. I'm not quite sure how much of that is coming out of our pockets. This is a guided rail bus system, which we've discussed on the programme here quite a bit before. In Nancy in France, a similar system has just been effectively discarded by the city council there. And in Cambridge, they've had all sorts of problems with implementing their guided rail bus system. And then there's also also the arena, which is costing around about £90-100 million, different estimates about how much that's going to happen, next door to Bristol Temple Mead Station on an old site there. So let's go around the table again and ask all of the politicians with us today what they think about those two projects, the Metro Bus and the arena, starting maybe with you, Helen Holland, from the Labour Party.
Well, our line on the arena is that, yes, we support the arena, but it's not at any price. And I think we need to have very clear scrutiny of the costs. If there are continued overruns, we need to be absolutely transparent about how that's happening, why it's happening. And we need to be clear that there have to be breakpoints, if you like, about the commitment to it, because what we don't want is a commitment to it and it gets so far down the line that whatever it costs, we've got to complete it. And I think this is another example that where the mayor needs to take people with him, because we've talked about the economic impact of the arena. It's going to sit in an area that is very close to some of the most deprived and disadvantaged parts of the city. And we want to be sure, as my colleague Estella Tinknell has said many times in the council chamber, that the people from that community aren't just working, providing the sandwiches and cleaning up in the arena, that they've got real jobs in the jobs that will come around the arena, hopefully, and that we're making sure that the pathways for local people getting those jobs are real. So yes, we support the arena, but not at any price.
Okay.
And certainly not if it undermines the Colston Hall.
And I want everyone to address this if you want to, which is, I mean, this effectively is a giant pop venue. Is this really the sort of thing that we should be spending our council taxpayers' money on, Gary Hopkins?
Actually, the Colston Hall is a very good point, because bluntly, the Colston Hall is more important to this city than the arena. It not only provides a concert venue for all sorts of different acts, but it's also an educational centre. So it actually puts a huge amount back into the city. And we had to fight, I'm glad to say, with support from other parties, to actually make the mayor realise that it needed to be invested in, which he wasn't going to be doing until a few months ago. The arena, basically, I think, in general, is a good thing for the city. But we do need to see more information, and we need to also be in a position where we can actually get the proper cost, because there will be mitigation.
Of course it's going to be good for the city, but is it good financially for the city?
Well, I think overall it should be, but we need. There's got to be truthfulness about this, and some of the mitigation measures that have got to be paid for, so that the residents in the areas roundabout are not actually majorly disadvantaged by the parking on their street and that sort of thing. That's a cost which, in any other major development, would be placed upon the developer.
Okay, Jeff Gollop, can I ask you, because we're coming up towards 7 o'clock, so let's try and get everyone in on here. Jeff Gollop, what's your thoughts about? And you can talk about the Metro Bus as well if you want, but these two big projects.
Right. My view is the arena is a really important message about Bristol, because it's indicating that Bristol is open for business, that it's vibrant, that things are happening. Helen's right. We've got to make sure that it creates real jobs for local people, not jobs for people outside of the region and only lowly paid jobs. It's got to be really positive. But just to pick up, when you talk about the 90 million and that it's being as though that's coming out of our revenue budget, the only thing that's coming out of our revenue budget is servicing the interest on a small part of the financing. The whole thing is hypothecated on the management company paying us a rental for using the arena, and on the future business rates coming from the new businesses that come into the area, we're actually able to fund some of the investment in respect of that. So it's actually a really positive model, and it's the first step in trying to prove that Bristol is justified in having more powers and more spending devolved towards it. So I see that as a very positive measure. The Metro Bus is a major investment in our transport infrastructure, and what it's doing is providing connection between the north and the south of the city, which is one of the important things we have to do. We have to create an opportunity where those who don't have jobs have the ability to get to them, and we also have to provide an opportunity where those who can bring work to people can actually get that work, can take jobs into certain parts of the city.
But we've been talking about a tram, haven't we? we, for decades. And this is a sort of halfway house.
It's a halfway house because the cost of a tram, we have to be pragmatic. And actually, we have to be pragmatic about what's available and grab the opportunities. And what's happened over the years is our leaders have spent too long talking, and every time they've got round to coming up with something they might be vaguely close to agreeing on, by the time they got there, the funding's been withdrawn. Now, for goodness sake, we've got an opportunity now. We've got to go ahead and make this work. The way the city is growing and developing, the metro bus system will provide a fantastic means of communication. It will, for example, be key for getting people into the arena to see what's going on. So I see it as a very positive thing, and I think it's a sign of the way the city's going and what the city's going to achieve.
Jeff, let's ask Michael Frost from the UK Independence Party, what are your thoughts on these two big projects?
Well, I agree with some of the points Helen made, that we've got to really scrutinise what this thing's going to cost. I think it's a good idea because...
this is the arena, yeah?
The arena we're talking about. I'll come on to the metro bus in a minute. It is a good idea. It puts Bristol on the map. It shows we're open for business, and there are many, it'll attract a lot of investment into the area. As far as real jobs are concerned, I don't know about that, because this is a venue which is going to be probably 90% menial sort of jobs, people letting people in and out of the arena, making sandwiches, looking after the facilities and all the rest of it. So how many real jobs, or real well-paid jobs, it's going to produce, I don't know. Metro bus, very important issue. We got into a spat with my Green colleague about the bit of scrubland that was occupied by all the lefty greenies that dug themselves in. This is going to cost the people of Bristol £400,000, and I will be putting in a Freedom of Information request to George to publish exactly what this fiasco cost, because he could have prevented it. So watch out for that one, George.
How could he prevent it? I mean, surely they
could have done something.
People have got a right to protest, haven't they?
Yes, they have, but they didn't have to be there for as long as they were there. They could have been removed from that site much faster than they were.
Can I just ask a point of Michael? Fine, ask, but just write to him. You don't have to go down the Freedom of Information request.
Oh, yes, you do. How many times have I stood up in the chamber and asked him a question, and he cannot answer a straight question?
Just write to him and send me a copy of the letter, and you will get a response.
Yeah. Okay, Tim Melnick, what are your thoughts on these two big projects, the arena and the metro?
It's all kicking off just before 7, Tony, isn't it? Right. I'm more concerned about Metrobus than the arena. I think the arena, on the whole, is okay, and as Jeff has explained, I won't reiterate, but the financing is complex, and it's basically a low interest loan that, all being well, the council will be able to pay off. There are big questions, and we've asked some of those this year, but it's not all from the revenue budget. And by the way, there's a lot of other things that the council spends money on, totaling, I don't know, maybe 600 or 700 million, isn't it? But anyway, the main question, in addition to the jobs point, which Helen's made very, very well, is how will we know if this decision pays back to the city? I think that's the thing I'm concerned with. People are saying it will be good for the city, it will create jobs. But I haven't seen, and I have asked for, any detail about the projections of what will an arena do for a city. And I think on that basis, it's very hard to know if it is successful. So I think what we need from the council is a much clearer business case, but we support it. Metrobus, we have big problems with. One issue is spiralling costs. This is a massive programme, and there's already been requests for extra funding. And we think it's poor value even at the current projected cost. But our real concern is if costs spiral. We think consultation has been quite bad. I think the land, as I've mentioned, is not scrub land. It's very important agricultural land. And I'd ask you, 400,000, well, that's what it is. But what is the cost to the city of not being able to grow our own food? That was our last question.
Do you think they're going to grow vegetables alongside the M32?
That's not this question, but they already are growing vegetables.
Michael,
there.
I'd quite like to hear from you how you thought that that should have been dealt with better, that protest. If you have any... if you have any professional expertise in that.
Well, I have a colleague who worked on the project from the start, and I won't mention his name because it's not fair to do that, but I do have a bit more information on this than I think most people do.
So what should have happened?
Well, they should have moved in much faster than they did. because they could have been removed nearly a month before they actually were. And in that month, they managed to dig themselves into the ground, hide themselves up in the trees, and make the whole thing a health and safety nightmare, not only for themselves, but also the people that had to go in and get them.
But that's our democratic right to protest. Anyway, time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. Our sister show, Dialect, is on Mondays at 11 a.m. this week. A unique show is touring the country about British history from the people's point of view. It's called 3 Acres and a Cow, and it's about how our ancestors were kicked off the land. Thanks for our guests to our guests, a Conservative on George Ferguson's cabinet, Jeff Gollop, Labour Group Leader Helen Holland, Liberal Democrat Group Leader Gary Hopkins, Green Councillor Tim Malnick, and you just heard there from Michael Frost, UK Independence Party Councillor. You can listen again or download what you've just heard at thisweekoneword.co.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. See you next week, where we'll be doing it all again, this time on national and international issues with some main parliamentary parties. Until then, don't let the banksters get you down.
Smile when you took them on, but you didn't take a peep in their artillery room.